I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. General Martin Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, said yesterday on This Week on ABC that ISIS fighters could launch indirect attacks inside Baghdad using mortar, rockets, and artillery. Meanwhile, in Syria, ISIS continues its attack on the town of Kobani near the Turkish border, clashing with Kurdish fighters. The U.S.-led coalition has been launching airstrikes against ISIS. We begin our conversation today on Radio Times with Liz Sly, Beirut bureau chief for The Washington Post, covering Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. And Liz Sly, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Liz, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, indeed. No, thanks so much for joining us once again on Radio Times. Let me ask you about Kobani and how it has become so strategically significant in this fight against ISIS.
Well, to tell you the truth, it's not that strategically significant at all. It's very interesting what has happened. It's a tiny little place, absolutely in the middle of nowhere, just surrounded by farmland. It connects nothing to nowhere. The Islamic State has overrun large swaths of Syria as well as Iraq over the past year. Many of those places were far more strategically important than Kobani. However, the timing of this and the location has been interesting because the Islamic State launched its assault there just a few days before the U.S. airstrikes began in Syria. And they advanced very rapidly towards the town. And the U.S. really didn't do anything to stop this. Its focus was on targets elsewhere, bigger, perhaps more significant targets elsewhere. But as the Islamic State reached the town, it's so close to the Turkish border that you can actually see the fighting, which is very unusual for these battles that the Islamic State is waging. So TV cameras rushed there. The next thing you know, it's all over the TV. And now Kobani has acquired this sort of international importance that if it wasn't for this convergence of timing and geography, might not have happened.
Mm. There was fighting over the weekend. This is Monday morning for us, probably Monday afternoon for you. Any way to know, I guess, who's winning or losing this battle for Kobani?
Well, it was clear in the first 3 weeks of this that the Islamic State was just slicing through this little enclave of Kurdish territory on the Turkish border. But since they reached the town, the U.S. airstrikes have started, and they have been quite intense. And they seem to have played quite a big role in halting this advance, not the battle, but the advance. And we can see signs of a sort of stalemate settling into the town. The Islamic State controls the eastern portion of it. The Kurds control the western portion of it. And the battle lines haven't moved much for several days now.
Are we talking about things like urban warfare? Are we kind of street-to-street combat?
Yes, we are talking about street-to-street combat in a very small town that's basically been abandoned by all of its civilians. But there are fighters from both sides, and they are fighting street-to-street. And I've been down there. I was down there just a few hours ago. You can hear the fighting very clearly from the Turkish border. It's not as intense at the moment as it has been in recent days, but you can hear that this is, urban combat, hand-to-hand battles in the streets of this town.
Is there any way to know today what the casualty count has been?
There have been no accurate or reliable casualty figures from this fighting. The Kurds claim they've killed hundreds, if not a thousand or more, Islamic State fighters. They claim they've lost about 50 of their own. We haven't seen a lot of civilian casualties. Most of the civilians ran into Turkey before this happened. The Kurds tell me that there have been 12 civilians killed. And the Islamic State doesn't put out figures of their own casualties, but some of the reports we're hearing from human rights monitor groups such as the Syrian Observatory in London, they say that the Islamic State has lost hundreds of fighters as well.
Tell us about the Kurdish fighters. These are and this is a town that's sort of part of a part of Syria that is in many ways under the control of the Kurds. Who are these Kurdish fighters?
Well, these Kurdish fighters belong to a group called the YPG, which is the military wing of a group called the PYD, which is affiliated to the Turkish PKK, which has been fighting the Turkish government for many, many years for an independent Kurdish state in Turkey. So they are designated as terrorists by Turkey and also as by the United States, which is one of the reasons why this battle really is so much more complicated than any fight that the Americans thought they were going to get into when they launched the attacks in Syria with the intent of only taking on ISIS.
And why are they called a terrorist organization?
Because they were blowing up Turkish troops and targets in Turkey over many, many years. And this war in Kobani has also come at a time when a peace process launched by the Turkish government had made some progress, but the Kurds in Turkey are now so angry about what's going on in Kobani that they are threatening to derail that peace process. So we have seen angry demonstrations in Turkey by Kurds against the Turkish government, and it's all becoming incredibly entangled and involved in lots of very different issues to the original goal of the U.S. intervention there, which was to fight ISIS.
Does that explain why Turkey has essentially been sitting on the border watching the fighting? Now, they have said that it would be okay for the U.S. and its coalition allies to use air bases and also to train some of the moderates fighting in Syria. But it has been unusual to see them sitting on the border watching the fighting in Kobani along with the rest of us.
Well, yes, you also have to remember that quite a lot of places along the Turkish border have fallen to ISIS over the past year or so. ISIS controls about a 250-kilometer stretch of the Turkish border at the moment. But yes, certainly one of the reasons why Turkey is not intervening is that it doesn't want to do anything to encourage these Kurds in their creation of a separate Kurdish state there that could encourage a separate state in Turkey. They also don't want to get involved for other reasons, such as not wanting to get involved in a war in Syria. Mm. And it also has to be remembered, but it isn't often pointed out, the Kurds also don't like Turkey very much, and they don't want Turkey to intervene. They don't want Turkey to send troops. What they do want, however, is for Turkey to allow them to get arms into the enclave so that they can fight ISIS, and Turkey has refused that.
Does Turkey see ISIS as a threat to itself?
Sorry?
Does Turkey see ISIS as a threat?
I think Turkey does see ISIS as a threat. It also sees this Kurdish group as a threat. I think Turkey sees them as an equal threat.
And you talked about the U.S.-led airstrikes, which have been, going on for the last couple of weeks. As you said, it seemed to help to bring a bit of a stalemate in this town of Kobani. Where else are these airstrikes being launched?
Well, we haven't seen very many in other parts of Syria lately, but in the beginning they were launched across a really wide area of territory in Syria against Islamic State targets, the same kind of things that we've seen them attack in Iraq. Checkpoints, bases, command and control centers, you know, their little headquarters and things like that, and vehicles. They mostly seem to be going after their vehicles.
We're talking with Liz Sly, the first of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. She's a Beirut bureau chief for the Washington Post, has been covering Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq, and joins us on Radio Times to essentially get us up to speed on what's been going on in that part of the world. Liz, every time we do a program about ISIS, I always ask this question, and I'll ask it of you as well. What makes ISIS such a formidable fighting force?
Well, first of all, they're very dedicated. They're ideologically committed. They have a lot of experience. Many of these fighters with the group had years of experience fighting the Americans in Iraq. They've got these foreigners who've come from overseas who have shared all commitments to family and everything else to participate in this fight. And they're really very enthusiastic, very well trained. And we've seen them get an enormous boost from the amount of weaponry they captured from the Iraqi army in Iraq over the past few months.
Is that military equipment that came originally from the United States?
Yes, this is the U.S.-supplied equipment to the Iraqi army that is now being used to wage the war in Syria and Iraq by the Islamic State.
So what is the difference between fighting the ISIS fighting in Syria and ISIS fighting in Iraq?
Well, there isn't a lot of difference in, like, their tactics and behavior. They regard this as one country. They've pretty much erased the border between the two countries by capturing the border posts along the countries. And I've been talking to people who live along that border. They say there are no checkpoints. You just move from one to the other. There's nothing to stop you. It is one country as far as they're concerned. And you can see them moving around the edges of this area they control, trying to push it out, trying to take control of some of those last areas that they see are still, that they see as belonging to their caliphate or Islamic State, and perhaps with a view to pushing on to further new conquests later on.
We have seen in the past, certainly, that the level of savagery and brutality from ISIS, is that continuing in the region as well?
Oh, yes. I don't think we've seen any let up in that. They have a very clear practice which they've declared themselves, that anybody who is an infidel or an unbeliever is an enemy to them and they will kill them. And when people try and turn against them, they suppress them with immense brutality, and that actually makes people afraid to turn against them, even though I don't believe the vast majority of people in the region want to live under this kind of rule.
And we're talking about horrible things like beheadings and crucifixions and torture and rape and slavery and killing children and captives, women, Christian Shiites. Yes?
Yes, all of the above. All of the above.
Let me ask you just a couple of questions about what's been happening in Iraq. And as I said at the beginning of the hour, General Martin Dempsey saying this yesterday, actually, on This Week on ABC, that ISIS fighters could be launching indirect attacks inside of Baghdad. And there were some suicide bombings in the last couple of days. Can you get us up to speed on what's going on in that country?
Well, I think it should be remembered that suicide bombings by the Islamic State, which was the Islamic State of Iraq before it changed its name a couple of times and is now the Islamic State, have not stopped since the Americans left, and they continued while the Americans were there. Baghdad has endured continual, steady suicide bombing since 03, 04. But what we have seen in the past few days is that ISIS has taken more areas of the province of Anbar, to the extent that it is now so close to Baghdad that it is within the range of ISIS artillery fire. And that is something to be very worried about for the capital and certainly for the American embassy in the capital, because they fear, you know, that they could actually have bombs raining down on them, as well as these targeted suicide attacks. And you can't defend against mortars. You can defend against suicide attacks up to a point by putting up these big blast walls and having a lot of checkpoints. But when they're firing artillery on you, that's a whole different matter.
We're almost out of time here, but it's a battle clearly on two fronts, or many fronts.
Yes, this is a multi-fronted battle. I mean, you've got fighting in the north of Iraq in Kurdistan. That battle is still going on. You've got the battle gathering pace around Baghdad, continuing in western Iraq, continuing in many, many parts of Syria, and this little place, Kobani, up here, it's raging there too.
Well, on that note, Liz Lai, thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And she's a Beirut bureau chief for the Washington Post, covering Syria, Lebanon, and Iraq. We have two guests waiting in the wings as we carry on our conversation, talking about ISIS, the fighting in Syria and Iraq, and questions about U.S. foreign policy. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY and presents Jitish Kalat, one of India's most influential contemporary artists and curator of India's upcoming International Biennale. Jitish Kalat will discuss his cutting-edge work and South Asia's growing impact on the global art scene. Jitish Kalat at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Sunday, October 19th at 2 p.m. The event is open to the public with limited seating. For reservations, 215-235-7469 or at philamuseum.org.
Bard College at Simon's Rock supports WHYY and will host Discovery Day, Saturday, October 25th at 8:30 a.m. Motivated students and their parents can learn how early college helps students innovate, accelerate, and excel. Discovery Day features information about academic and residential programs, tours, interviews, sample classes, and more. More at simons-rock.edu. Discovery Day, coming October 25th.
Fox Chase Cancer Center is a proud supporter of WHYY. One of the newest advances in the fight against cancer is immunotherapy, a treatment that unleashes your body's own immune system so it can better fight cancer cells. Early results from studies at Fox Chase Cancer Center and other cancer centers show promise, even in patients who did not respond to other treatments. Learn more at 888-FOX-CHASE or foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, part of Temple Health, your first choice in cancer care.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The United States and its coalition partners have been launching airstrikes against ISIS militants who continue their military campaign in Iraq and Syria. And joining us to talk about the U.S. strategy in the region, the role that Turkey is playing, and the competing goals of the coalition are Stephen Cook and Frederick Wary. Stephen Cook is the Haseb Sabah Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Stephen Cook, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Pleasure to be with you.
Also with us is Frederick Wary, and he's Senior Associate Middle East Program for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And Frederick Wary, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Great to be here. Thanks.
You're welcome. Let me begin with you, if I could, Frederick, which is, how has ISIS been able to conquer and control so much territory in Iraq and Syria? I ask that knowing that the U.S. spent millions of dollars training Iraqi forces, for instance.
Well, I think it's a combination of their own proficiency and then also the disarray of their opponents. We have to remember that this is a group that's been in operation in various permutations for quite a while. They've built up a cadre of expertise. They benefit also from the massive defection of former Iraqi army officers, former Baathists, who actually have combat experience. There's been some battle-hardened foreign commanders from Chechnya that have come over and helped them. They've captured advanced weaponry, armored vehicles, artillery. But I think more importantly, they've been tapping into grievances of the populations where they've come in. Specifically the Sunnis in western Iraq. But I think really the deciding factor in a lot of this was the utter hollowness of the Iraqi security forces that just melted away due to corruption and nepotism in their ranks.
Do you think, Stephen Cook, that ISIS can be defeated as the president talks about?
Well, it does not seem that the ISIS can be defeated. The ISIS is an iteration of a number of different groups dating back even before the American invasion of Iraq. It's obviously been given new life since 2003. But as we've seen in our more than decade now fight against global terrorism, that we knock out one group or a set of leaders and others come back. So I think that this is a long process. I think the idea of degrading ISIS is probably more realistic than absolutely defeating ISIS. One of its predecessors was al-Qaeda of Iraq, which we believe that we had defeated when we killed its leader, Abu Musab Zarqawi, in, I believe, 2006, and we're essentially fighting the latest iteration of that same organization now.
I was talking with Liz Sly about the fighting in Kobani. This is this town or city near the Turkish border. Frederick Wary, is Kobani a must-win for the Kurds who are fighting there, for U.S., for NATO?
Well, starting with the Kurds, I mean, I think we could compare it very roughly to their Alamo. I mean, this is a town of incredible significance for the Syrian Kurds and also Kurds in Turkey as well. I mean, it's really sort of their seat of their zone in Syria. It would deal a devastating blow to their morale. You know, but again, if we look at the actual strategic significance of this for what appears to be the U.S. strategy, it appears to be somewhat secondary. From what the Pentagon is saying, the U.S. is really going after ISIS's capabilities in Iraq. I mean, we know, as we heard, that ISIS is within shelling range of Baghdad. So clearly a lot of U.S. effort is being poured into defeating or degrading ISIS in Iraq. That said, I mean, I think the fall of Kobani would have significant, you know, political effects for what's happening inside Turkey with Turkey's problems with its own Kurdish population, with the PKK. So I think it would be very significant.
Well, let me toss that to you as well, Stephen Cook. You've written about Turkey and its relationship with the PKK, and it is so curious to see Turkish troops essentially on the border watching, as we all are, watching this fight over the town for Kobani. They are now apparently going to allow the U.S. and coalition partners to use air bases to launch strikes against ISIS. But help us understand how Turkey sees this conflict.
Well, it's complicated, obviously, for the Turks. Kobani may not be of strategic importance to the United States. And I agree with Frederick. There are bigger issues for the United States than Kobani. But it is extraordinarily important for Syria's Kurds, for Turkey's Kurds, and for Iraq's Kurds, which make it a strategic issue for the Turks. The Turks are quite concerned about an autonomous Kurdish region in Syria, as there is now one in Iraq, and what that might mean for Turkey's own security and large Kurdish population of about 14 million people. As a result, they have been playing this game and have been allowing ISIS essentially to hammer away at Kobani to kind of prevent the emergence of this autonomous Kurdish region. This has had domestic implications for Turkey as well. Turkey is engaged in a long-term peace process with the Kurdistan Workers Party, known as the PKK. The PKK has threatened to call off that peace process and its ceasefire should the Turks continue to refrain from helping the Kurds in Kobani and preventing Kurdish fighters from crossing over the Turkish border into Syria to help the people in Kobani. In one sense, from the outside, it doesn't make sense. ISIS, one would think, is a threat to Turkey. But I think in the historic drama and the conflict between Kurdish nationalism and Turkish nationalism, the current Turkish government has chosen that the greater of those two evils, at least for the moment, is Kurdish nationalism. And just to clarify, the Turks have said in principle that they would allow the use of Incirlik Air Base for allied air forces. They haven't enumerated precisely what they will allow. They have been previously quite allergic to the use of that airbase for airstrikes and the like. It may be there is now a Pentagon team now going to Ankara to negotiate with the Turks about what kind of operations we can run out of Incirlik. It may very well be that all that they allow is intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and humanitarian missions from that airfield. So we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves. The Turks are really hammered by significant security and political dilemmas. And I think the issue over Incirlik reveals all of those.
Well, Frederick, let me go back to you and throw something else in the mix. We're talking about a very complicated situation here. But if ISIS is either defeated or degraded, and one wonders whether that will happen or not, does that end up empowering Assad in Syria, who also wants ISIS to go?
I mean, I think in very rough terms, you could argue it will. But I mean, again, this is a regime that I think long ago sort of sacrificed a lot of its legitimacy. And I mean, he's facing pressure from many different quarters. I think it would certainly relieve some pressure on the Eastern Front. It would allow the redeployment of some crack units that have been putting pressure on ISIS to sort of concentrate on the regime and defend the regime. So I mean, if you look at the concerns of the Arab states that are signing up with the coalition with the United States to go after ISIS, this is their principal concern, is that, you know, if we attack ISIS, it will basically create this vacuum that will benefit the regime, and so they're very concerned that they're acting in effect as sort of Assad's air force. So I mean, this is an incredibly complex, multidimensional conflict.
Well, in fact, picking up on that, to you, Stephen Cook, the Turkish president said the goal is to defeat Assad. I mean, he's saying that's our number one goal.
Right, and this is the problem. This has been the gap between the United States in Turkey. The Turks believe that the way to resolving the ISIS problem is through regime change in Damascus. That may be simplistic, given the complexities of the civil war in Syria. It also is a bit self-serving, since the Turks had been at the forefront of demanding regime change in Damascus. But nevertheless, that's what they believe, and they've been reluctant to become an open and active member of the anti-ISIS coalition because they don't believe that the U.S. strategy against ISIS will work, because there is no real change in the U.S. approach to the Assad regime. Until they see that, I'm afraid they're not going to commit in the way that U.S. officials and others would like them to commit.
Is that because President Obama is willing to bomb ISIS but not bomb Assad strongholds?
That's precisely the case. I think, you know, the Turks, for the United States, the priority here is Iraq. For the Turks, the priority is Syria. And they believe that once you deal with the Assad regime, you've effectively brought the ISIS situation into a more manageable realm, if not actually defeating ISIS.
Fred, let me ask you a bit about the coalition. And it's a pretty large coalition made up of a number of different countries. Do they all want the same thing?
Well, this is the thing. I mean, I think many of the Arab Gulf states are participating in the ISIS anti-ISIS coalition with the expectation or the hope that I think it will eventually drift toward Assad himself. You know, each of these states brings their own concerns. They face significant domestic pressures from their own populations about their participation in bombing ISIS, especially in Saudi Arabia, where you get the sense from Saudis across the spectrum that, you know, bombing ISIS will effectively empower the Shia. It will empower the Iranians. So many of these regimes have different calculations. The British and the French are I think, focused primarily on Iraq. I mean, there's some sensitivities there with bombing in Syria as well.
Well, and this is actually an email from Gary. What would happen if there was no intervention after all? A question I had as well. And Stephen Cook, I don't know if you can run, you know, it might be too late to run this experiment, but if the U.S. was not involved and sort of just let forces work themselves out on the ground, where do you think we'd be today?
Oh, well, I think it's clear, given the way in which ISIS has been able to storm into Iraq, take over large parts of the country, the combination of the use of American weaponry that we had given to the Iraqi army, the fact that there are Baathist military officers who are at the head of ISIS, I think that it would be clear that the United States' allies, such as they are in the region, the Iraqi security forces and the Kurdish Peshmerga, would have a much more difficult time dealing with the ISIS threat. I think that the question is born from the idea, and that some have floated in the policy discussions about the Syrian civil war, but you can expand it to Iraq. We don't like any of these people, with the exception of the Kurds. Why don't we just let them all fight it out, given the fact that, you know, this is Al-Qaeda, this is ISIS, this is Iraqi Shia militias, and so on and so forth, that wouldn't be better for them to just fight it all out and leave the United States out of it? In one way, that makes sense. But in reality, I think what we would find is that the Islamic State, which is a threat to the United States' interests in the region and its allies in the region, it would have advanced much further than it already has.
Do you agree with that, Frederick?
I do. I do. And I would just add the additional threat. And again, I want to caveat this. I mean, I think it's been overblown. But this notion that ISIS, you know, if it's left to its own devices, could develop the capability to attack the U.S. homeland, I think there's no U.S. official that wants to take that chance. And so I think that's an additional impetus for the U.S. intervention.
And that's Frederick Wary. He's senior associate for the Middle Eastern program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Also with us is Stephen Cook. He's a senior fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And we are talking about the conflict in the Middle East. We've been getting an update on the battle over a town called Kobani. It's in northern Syria near the Turkish border. We began with Liz Sly, Washington Post bureau chief, talking about the fighting in Kobani. talking with Stephen Cook and Frederick Wary now about U.S. policy, the threat that is posed or not posed by ISIS, and various strategies to deal with the conflicts there. We want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And I'm Marty Moscoen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. To you, Frederick Wary, do you think the U.S. is going to have to put boots on the ground?
I think that's a real distinct possibility and probability, but it's what kind of boots. I mean, we know from previous air campaigns that air power is really most effective when it's coordinated by controllers or advisors on the ground that can call in the strikes, that could coordinate with ground forces. I mean, this is the case with the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan. It happened in Libya with the defense of several key towns. There were special operation forces on the ground calling in those airstrikes. And I think that explains why we haven't seen these airstrikes take full effect. So again, I think we'll see a contingent of advisors, of controllers on the ground. I just politically don't think another massive troop deployment is in the cards, both for military reasons, then also, you know, political reasons. I think it could actually be an antibody that could draw more fighters to the conflict. So I think the U.S. is going to be very careful about the number and the type of people it puts on the ground. But I think we can expect that.
What do you think, Stephen?
I agree with Frederick. I think ultimately the airstrikes are much more effective with ground controllers and people directing them from the battlefield. I think that as far and as long as the Iraqi security forces demonstrate that they're not entirely up to this task, slowly but surely we'll have more kinds of advisors and people involved. I'm not sure that it's politically tenable to deploy large numbers of forces to Iraq anytime in the near future. But it's interesting that Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Martin Dempsey, did indicate over the weekend that as things go along, different, quote-unquote, different kinds of advising might be necessary.
Are we talking about things like special forces, do you think, Stephen?
We already have those special forces on the ground, and it's likely that we would see more going forward. Again, as Frederick said, those airstrikes are much more effective when they are guided from forces on the ground, and that's one of the things that special forces operators do. But again, it is a problem. Certainly, ISIS doesn't represent a threat to the American homeland, but they would like to fight us on the ground in Iraq and Syria.
About a minute before our break here, to you, Frederick Wary, though, isn't this the definition then of mission creep?
Well, that's certainly the case, given the history of Vietnam and others. So, I just hope that the White House is sensitive to that creep. But we know. I mean, if we're dealing with an unreliable partner on the ground, such as the Iraqi security forces, there's the real temptation to just keep trying to bolster them, to keep trying to shore up their backbone, and that could lead very dangerously, I think, to more and more troops coming in.
But, I mean, as you said, politically, the president, he talked about stupid wars. I mean, the president campaigned on getting out of Iraq. It's hard to imagine him wanting to get back. And clearly he doesn't want to get back in, but I guess being forced to get back in.
Frederick? That's right. But if we're facing clear defeat, if the strategy isn't working, and again, he kicks this off to the next administration, then, who knows? It's really the choice about what kind of victory will we want to have, and this is the way these quicksand wars happen. You deploy a certain amount, it doesn't work, and then you've got to change your strategy, more and more numbers. So this is the drift. And it just speaks to the danger of limited wars, that military theory generally requires overwhelming and decisive force.
And that's Frederick Wary, Senior Associate for the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Also with us, Stephen Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us.
The
The Philadelphia Museum of Art supports WHYY and presents Jitish Kalat, one of India's most influential contemporary artists and curator of India's upcoming International Biennale. Jitish Kalat will discuss his cutting-edge work and South Asia's growing impact on the global art scene. Jitish Kalat at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Sunday, October 19th at 2 p.m. The event is open to the public with limited seating. For reservations, 215-235-7469 or at philamuseum.org.
Bard College at Simon's Rock supports WHYY and will host Discovery Day, Saturday, October 25th at 8:30 a.m. Motivated students and their parents can learn how early college helps students innovate, accelerate, and excel. Discovery Day features information about academic and residential programs, tours, interviews, sample classes, and more. More at simons-rock.edu. Discovery Day, coming October 25th.
Fox Chase Cancer Center is a proud supporter of WHYY. One of the newest advances in the fight against cancer is immunotherapy, a treatment that unleashes your body's own immune system so it can better fight cancer cells. Early results from studies at Fox Chase Cancer Center and other cancer centers show promise, even in patients who did not respond to other treatments. Learn more at 888-FOX-CHASE or foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, part of Temple Health, your first choice in cancer care.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about the fighting in Iraq and Syria, the threat posed by ISIS, Turkey's reluctance to get involved in the fight against ISIS, also analyzing U.S. strategy in Syria and Iraq. And again, our guests are Stephen Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations, Frederick Wary, Senior Associate of the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And again, you can join our conversation by calling 1-888-477-9499. What do you think President Obama should do? You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stephen Cook, there is a theory out there, and I want to try it out on both of you, that sort of at the root of all this fighting and conflict in the Middle East is oil and oil companies. I'm not saying whether I believe that or not, but it's a theory that's been floating around. I'd be curious about your response to that.
Well, this has been a theory that people have advanced since the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and I don't think it stands up. This has not been a goal of the United States. And if certainly the United States wanted to buy oil from Saddam Hussein, we would have gone ahead and bought oil from Saddam Hussein and lifted the sanctions, allowed American oil companies to do business there. There were multiple reasons for American involvement in Iraq beginning in 2003 and continued involvement in Iraq. But I don't think that oil was the central reason for it.
What do you think, Frederick Wary?
I would agree with that. I mean, this is really about sort of the security of key Arab partners, of allies in the region. It's about geopolitics. It's about really the security of Saudi Arabia in some sense. And in that sense, I guess it could impact oil. I mean, but, you know, there's a lot of other threats driving this than you know, simple, you know, profits or the need to ensure access for oil companies.
What about Assad? I mean, ISIS has taken up so much of the sort of, you know, first paragraph of when we're talking about this conflict here. I'm back to you, Stephen. I mean, if Assad goes, and I realize that's a big if, what kind of effect would that have on Syria? And I ask that looking at what happened in Libya after that strongman went, and whether Libya is a kind of a cautionary tale for Syria.
Well, I think that Libya and Syria are obviously different in the particulars of it, but I think this is the reason why the Turkish idea that if you just take out the Assad regime, that you resolve or help to resolve the ISIS problem is simplistic. There's no indication that if Assad were to go, that the fighting in Syria would end. Certainly the remnants of the Assad regime, the Assad's allies from Hezbollah, the Iranians, would continue the fight after Bashar al-Assad fell. And there's no indication that the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria and other extremist groups operating on the other side of the conflict would end as well. It has no longer, the conflict is no longer just about the Assad regime. This has become something much more than just a Syrian civil war. It's a proxy battle. It's a battle between extremist groups. It's has an overlay of sectarian conflict. And it strikes me that as long as the Assad regime remains there or not, Syria is going to be a zone of conflict in the Middle East for quite some time.
Frederick Wary, President Obama has said or still seems to believe that there's some kind of a political settlement for Syria's civil war. Do you agree with that?
Well, that's certainly the, I mean, the sort of best case scenario from his perspective. I mean, I think you're, you know, you're really talking about getting the Russians and the Iranians on board. My question is who is really left to negotiate with, because I think Assad has really lost control of a lot of, you know, branches of his government. My understanding is the regime is incredibly, you know, fragmented. We may be past the point of a political solution. I mean, going back to Steve's point that, you know, I mean, over the course of the civil war, I mean, Assad has really devolved power to militias. He's created these self-defense forces. He's created the Alawites. He's sectarianized this this conflict. And I just think the notion of some sort of, you know, power-sharing agreement, you know, we could be past that point.
Mm. Should Obama start bombing Assad's forces, though, Frederick?
Well, no, that's an entirely different, you're in an entirely different, you know, scenario there with regard to the Iranians. We have to remember the ongoing nuclear negotiations with the Iranians right now. I mean, to start bombing, I think, would effectively sabotage those talks. He's got enough on his plate right now in eastern Syria.
And just so we understand, Iran and Assad, they're allies in this, right, Frederick?
That's right. I mean, Iran is all in here. I mean, they've been essentially, doing intervention in Syria, training his forces, advising them. I mean, they've been coordinating the support by Lebanese Hezbollah. So he's a key ally for them, and we don't see any indications that they're willing to back off of that.
Stephen, sounds like you wanted to add something. Go ahead.
Let me just add a further complication to this, that this issue of the United States bombing Syrian forces has come up, and the Iranians have stated very clearly that if the United States did that, it would have a negative impact on Israeli security. So you can see that we are not just talking about Syria and the United States or Syria and the different groups that's fighting the Assad regime. We're now bringing a whole host of other factors into it that make the Syrian conflict extraordinarily complex for the United States.
And that's Stephen Cook. Also with us, Frederick Wary. We are talking about Syria. We're talking about Iraq. We're talking about ISIS and the conflict in the Middle East, and also U.S. foreign policy. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get James from, looks like, Allentown to join our conversation. Hi, James. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Well, I have a comment first. A lot of battles historically take place in places that are initially not seen as strategic, but the effect later, or perceived as strategic, but later the effect is absolutely important. You could go back to Tobruk Forum and Augustus is losing his legion there. That has a great psychological impact on the Roman Empire, for example. You could probably even argue the Battle of Marathon was not taken at a strategic place initially. That's my first comment.
Okay.
That refers to the your reporter from Lebanon.
Talking about Kobani, comment, yes. Go ahead.
Yes. The second comment I have is that the Kurds are an ethnically consistent cultural group that has always been pretty supportive of the United States, and we didn't support them when they were dealing in Iran with the Shah because of that relationship, and yet you have all these liberation movements after the Second World War. Why weren't the Kurds given their own territory? I know that the part of Syria, part of Turkey, part of Iran, and part of Iraq, but they're a consistent group, And well, I think the United States has mishandled that policy.
Well, James, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let's talk a bit about the Kurds. And Stephen, if I can go back to you, Kurds often described as America's only true friend in the region. But, you know, James is saying that we have fallen down on that as well. Do you agree?
Well, certainly the Kurds have been caught in the geopolitics of the region. The United States has not wanted to undermine its own relations with Turkey, that has feared Kurdish autonomy and independence, has not wanted to undermine, when it had good relations with the Iranians, its relations with the Shah of Iran, and has pursued a Baghdad first policy when it comes to Iraq. Just to clarify, though, with the caller, it is sure. True, the Kurds, broadly speaking, are all related to each other, but they're not as homogeneous as one might think. There are different linguistic groups within the Kurds. The Iraqi Kurds think of the Syrian and Turkish Kurds as cousins, but not necessarily the same people. They certainly have ethnic affinities, but and there is a kind of broad romantic view of a greater Kurdistan. But I think that the Kurds themselves, specifically those in Iraq, have more limited aims when it comes to Kurdish nationalism.
But, Frederick, it is interesting to think about the Kurds, you know, wanting, if not autonomy, some, you know, regional control, which they have in some parts of the Middle East. ISIS, in a sense, wanting the same thing. Are we seeing the falling apart of country boundaries in the Middle East?
Well, that's been the standard line for quite some time now, that the post-Ottoman borders are being redrawn, that these states that were always very fragile, their borders are being reconstituted along new sectarian and ethnic lines. I think there's some danger with that, because I think over the course of the 20th century, the identities and the powers of these states have been solidified, and we're seeing, obviously, some of the breakdown. But these new entities that are emerging, whether Kurdistan, whether ISIS, are not self-sustaining. They're not sufficient replacement. So I think it's best to describe what is happening as sort of zones of autonomy. I mean, whether we're talking about eastern Libya, I was just there. We're talking about northern Iraq with the Kurds, where under the no-fly zone in the 90s, they've really developed what is effectively a sub-state. And then there's ISIS. But I mean, let's not kid ourselves. These borders are I think very solid, and I don't think that these entities are really capable of evolving into real states.
Does that mean they'll eventually just kind of fall apart of their own weight, or that they will be defeated? How do you see that, Frederick?
That you mean the ISIS? Or
yes,
these sort
ISIS.
Of subs? Well, in the case of ISIS, I mean, look, it's sort of had this honeymoon period where it's been described as a juggernaut. It's you know, swept across territories. They are trying to govern, but it's built really along the lines of a sort of shaky coalition of Sunni tribes, ex-Baathists. I mean, I think what you're starting to see in places is the tribal backlash. I mean, these tribes don't like living under their draconian social rules. It's unclear to me if ISIS can really deliver services. I mean, certainly they're in the sort of this honeymoon stage, but we know from previous emirates in history, or these attempts by jihadi or Islamist groups to set up these emirates, is that they tend to collapse on their own weight. So I would expect that for ISIS as well.
Do you expect the same, Stephen?
It's certainly the case that ISIS is not endearing itself to the populations in which it now controls. That doesn't necessarily mean, particularly in the case of Iraq, that those tribes in Anbar province in western Iraq are necessarily enamored with the government in Baghdad as well. So I think I agree with Frederick on everything he said. I think the borders of the region are more institutionalized than people have made out, except in Iraq. Iraq may no longer make sense to the people who live there. Certainly doesn't make sense to the Kurds, who sense an opportunity. They've been somewhat muted since their defeat over the summer at the hands of ISIS, but nevertheless see in the current conflict as a way forward to realizing their dreams of an independent Kurdistan. That may not happen sooner, but they certainly expect it will happen later. As I said, the tribal groupings in western Iraq don't necessarily want to be ruled from Baghdad. And it's really not a question of who in Baghdad. It's a question of their relationship with Baghdad. Anybody in Baghdad. And this has a dynamic effect on the way in which rulers rule in Baghdad. For example, the more kind of these centripetal forces work on the Kurds and others to pull away, leaders in Baghdad tend to try to centralize power more, which only creates further pressure for the disintegration of the state.
And that's Stephen Cook, who joins us along with Frederick Wary. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. In the couple of minutes that we have left, you know, I think you've done a fabulous job of sort of laying out all the complexities and challenges. I'm curious to you, Frederick Wary, sort of, you know, what happens, especially with U.S. foreign policy? What happens? Do we continue the bombing campaign and see how it goes? Is that a helpful way to look at this crisis?
I would hope that they're not doing that, that they're not just waiting. I mean, I hope there's sort of a thought-out strategy here. I mean, I think we're starting to see sort of the slowdown of the tempo of the air campaign because they've already hit a lot of the sort of fixed targets, headquarters, ammo depots, and now they're trying to go after the much more elusive mobile targets. And as we know, ISIS is adapting. But, I mean, I think the next phase of this is really the partnering with forces on the ground, and that's going to be the much tougher challenge. I mean, whether it's sort of breathing life into these defunct Iraqi security forces, advising them, shoring them up, or in the case of Syria, trying to identify and vet capable opposition forces and train them. And this is going to be a long-term process. I mean, we're really talking about months and you know, years, I think, for the ground forces to emerge that can actually confront ISIS.
Final 45 seconds to you, Stephen Cook. Your thoughts?
Well, this is, I think, one of the most complex foreign policy challenges that the Obama administration has faced. And I think that going forward, it's just going to get more and more difficult for the reasons that Frederick pointed out. One of the unfortunate aspects is that we seem to be bombing Iraq because we've been bombing Iraq for 25 years, that we have this kind of vested interest in what happens in Iraq that we wouldn't otherwise have. And nobody's really kind of thought about what alternatives are. There is no alternative now that we're engaged in this fight with ISIS. But I'm afraid what it means is whether there are boots on the ground or not, we're fully engaged in Iraq for years to come.
Well, on that very depressing note, Stephen Cook, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
And Frederick Wary, thank you very much for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're welcome. Frederick Wary, Senior Associate for the Middle East Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Stephen Cook, Senior Fellow for Middle Eastern Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.